where were you in your life at the point where you decided to adopt from China, and what was going on in your thinking?
Well, I mean, the decision to adopt from China was an end result of many years of change. So, you know, I grew up in a Mormon family, in a Mormon culture. In my culture growing up, you know, there was large families. We were told that, you know, that we had to have children to bring, you know, spirits down to earth and stuff like that. So I grew up in a culture that advocated for having lots of kids. And, you know, in the late 80s, I started reading. I read one article that really probably was a pivotal article for me, and that was on the extinction of the black rhino in Africa. And it talked about the growing population in Africa and how it was resulting in these animals, black rhino and others, being driven to pretty much extinction. And reading that article caused me to think about man's place on Earth, and it really changed my view of having a lot of kids. I'd been married about 5 years by that point, and we were kind of happy in our little, you know, double income, no kids life. And we weren't preventing kids from happening, but it wasn't, you know, an urgent matter with us at that point. And so I began to reflect on, you know, the need to have biological children. It became, you know, a question not just of, well, they'll come, but the question is, do I even want a biological child to come? And this evolved for another 5 years or so, and I studied more and more, and I just really came to the firm conclusion, you know, in the early 90s, that I didn't want to bring another human into the world biologically. And I sat down with my then wife and told her that, and she, you know, she was pretty much okay with it. She had a lot of medical issues, so she was concerned with the genetic side of biological children a little bit. And so we both came to an agreement, yeah, this is fine. Let's just continue on as we're going. And that was the way it was. I was a rabid anti-child, you know, person for nearly a decade. And then in 1996, I read, you know, press releases and stories about China's dying rooms. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm in this kind of zero growth mindset. Here's a country that's trying to do something about their population. I support that desire. Maybe adopting would be a way to have children, but yet also support a population growth agenda. And so I pondered that for, you know, a couple months and really didn't say anything to anybody about it. It was just something that was percolating. And then one Sunday we were coming back from church, and my then wife had been in a church class where a woman had talked about her trip to China with her husband on a medical project, and she'd visited an orphanage, and she'd come back and said, my goal is to find homes for all the kids that were in this orphanage. And my wife at that time said, I think we should adopt from China. And I said, that's amazing, because that's exactly what I've been thinking about for the last couple months. Let's do it. And so we started from scratch, started investigating, you know, how to adopt from China. And finally, in early 1998, March of 1998, we received a referral for our oldest daughter, Makina. And so then in April, we went, and the rest is history, as they say.
So you went and you adopted Makina, and then at some point, your marriage broke up.
All right. So when we got back from with Makina, I mean, China was a life-changing experience on many levels. I mean, from a cultural point of view, I saw a world that I'd never seen before, a people that I'd never seen before. You know, I fell deeply in love with China on our first trip. I just loved so many things about it, their sense of community, their humbleness, their openness. You know, it's just everything that I found really are my American society to not be. So it was something I was drawn to. And so we came back with Makina, and we both intellectually knew that, you know, raising an only child probably wasn't in the best interest of making it. So we thought, all right, let's go back to China and adopt again. So 6 months, we were told we had to wait 6 months. We, on the almost to the day, 6 months later, we submitted our second dossier to adopt another girl. So we were in the middle of this wait. Going back to 1988 or 89, the article that had started me on this path, you know, at odds with my Mormon culture, eventually resulted in me spiritually and emotionally and intellectually leaving the Mormon Church. And this was quite concerning to my then wife, who was a very devout member of the Mormon Church. And it kind of crystallized and became a huge issue while we were waiting for the referral for our second daughter. And it was such a important issue on both of our sides that we decided that we could not remain married. She couldn't remain married to a person who was not actively trying to destroy her belief system, but with my associations with friends and others, you know, in our house, we would have conversations that would leave her tremendously bothered about things that she was hearing. And it just became, it came to a head one night when she was driving home from Salt Lake, and she came home and said, you know, I was praying and God told me that if I don't get divorced from you, that you will destroy my testimony. And so that became kind of the culmination. I won't say that this occurred in a vacuum, because that certainly would be unfair. There were many issues at play. But we both decided that it was probably better for both of us if we did not remain married. So she called up the agency immediately and said, we need to withdraw the application for the second girl. In the months since we'd submitted the application, I had kind of emotionally accepted the reality of a second daughter. And I felt like, I don't want to belittle the idea of a miscarriage or anything like that, but I did feel like somebody had died when my wife, then wife, withdrew the application, that I felt like there was a sense of loss. And so as soon as the divorce was finalized, literally the day the divorce, I received the divorce decree, I called the agency and said, okay, I want to reapply as a single father. And so I turned in my application right as China's policies towards single parent adoption was changing. Just under the wire, got it in, and in March of 2002, received a referral for my daughter Megan.
And then you, in the course of being in China, you met Lon, your current wife, and the two of you adopted Meilan together. In what year?
Well, you are really hurtling through time and space.
Hey, we got half an hour.
On the trip to adopt Megan, we were shopping on Shaman Island, as, you know, adoptive families are wont to do. And I walked into a store. Whether I met Lon on that trip is open to debate. We don't remember. It was not a, you know, real consequential event. So, you know, we were just, you know, shopping. I mean, I don't remember who I meet in stores, and she doesn't remember all the customers that came in the store. But I did order a custom painting from her store of both my daughters, and she got my email address and so on. And through the summer, as the painting was being done, she would email me, of course, you know, updates of the painting. And I would start emailing her back saying, you know, you're a woman in China. I'm raising these two Chinese girls. I would love to kind of get your perspective on what life is like in China for a woman. And so she was agreeable. And so we spent a lot of time emailing. I would email her questions. She'd email me back answers and so on. And in the course of that time, I organized a trip to go back to China to do some additional research. And I asked her if she wanted to be my guide for that trip. And she said, I would love to. I've, you know, been working with adoptive families for years with my store, but I've never been to an orphanage. I would love to go to an orphanage. So she was my guide on that trip. And then we started dating through my research projects in China, and then got married 2 years later. After we got married in October of 2004, we went back to China to celebrate the wedding with her family. And, of course, paid for the trip by doing some research in Henan province by Beijing. And so We went to this orphanage for a bunch of families that wanted us to do some research, and I was videotaping the baby rooms and the kids and stuff like that to make a DVD for the families. And when we were done, we got back in the taxi and we were driving back to the hotel, and Lon says, "I just met a girl. I think we should adopt her." And I was like, wait a second, we've only been married a month, maybe a month and a half. And, this isn't even on our radar. I don't think so. I don't even know how this would work. And so she says, "No, you really need to meet this kid." So we went back that evening to the orphanage and asked the director if we could take this child with a couple of her friends. We didn't want her to think we were like focused on her or anything. And can we take them to the area McDonald's? And so he said that was okay. So we took these three kids to McDonald's and let them play and eat and so on. And sure enough, I mean, this kid was just radiant. I mean, she was happy and singing and just really engaging. And so we brought her back to the orphanage and we talked about it. And I said, "Well, I have no idea how we can do this. I mean, I know that the CCAA doesn't allow designated adoptions and so on. So we're going to have to find out if this is even possible." So we went back to the orphanage. She said, "Well, the director said, the only way you'd be able to do it is as a domestic adoption. Lon would have to adopt her as a single mom." And so we thought, well, I guess that's a possibility, but I have to find out, how to do it on my end. I mean, I don't want to adopt a kid in China and then not be able to get her to the United States. So I said, "Lon, you go back to your family planning office. I'll go back to the INS in the United States. We'll all see if, we can put together a way to do this." So she did that. She went to the family planning office and walked in and said, "I'd like to adopt this girl." And she said, "Okay, well, are you married?" "No, I'm a single girl." And they're like, "You want what? What?" I mean, they literally could not comprehend what she was asking them. They were like, "Wait a second, why are you as a single woman wanting to adopt a child? I mean, that's the opposite of what is going on in like 99.9% of the situations." And so they didn't even know how to process her request. It took them a couple weeks to finally come back and say, "Okay, I think we figured out how to do this, get you the permission, get you the certificate and everything." I am at the same time going to the INS office and saying, "Okay, my wife is adopting this child in China. How would we get her over to the United States?" The official in the INS office said, "Okay, well, no problem. Since you two are married, therefore any children of her are by default going to be your children. So it's just filling out an application, getting her over here. How long will it take?" Maybe 2 to 3 months at the most." I said, "Really? I mean, it's just that simple?" "Yeah, it's that simple." "All right." So I called Lon in China. I said, "Really, it doesn't seem like there's that big of a, that much to do over on my end." She says, "Well, I got permission from the family planning on my end. Let's do it." So in February of 2005, we took the whole family, my other two daughters and myself, we went back to Luoyang in Henan, and we adopted Meilan. And so then, I had to begin processing the paperwork, and one thing led to another, and 16 months later, we got Meilan's visa to come back home.
Wow. So
we call those the dark years.
Yeah, that was quite a lot of pirouetting you had to do. But I'll tell you, among the many, many things I find so interesting about your story is that you started out in a faith that's all about children. And you were not convinced that you wanted children. So there's this sort of irony there. And you got interested in China and adoption from China in part because China was making an effort to control its population, right? So it resonated with your concerns about overpopulation, the kind of depletion of the earth. And now, the work that you do and the role that you play in the Chinese adoption community as somebody who does research for adoptive families and to their adoptive children's backgrounds and who has spoken very frankly about your very real concerns about corruption in the adoption system in China. And I wonder now how, you know, where you are in terms of how you think about China's one child, now two child policy. It back in the beginning of all this, it seemed like a good thing to you that China was trying to do something about its population. What do you think about it now, you know, fast forwarding, knowing what you do, both as an adoptive father of three Chinese kids and even more as a person who's been really involved in so much research on behalf of adoptive families? What do you think of the one child policy now?
It's become a lot more nuanced and complicated. I'm still highly supportive of the philosophical underpinning of the one-child policy. I mean, I do believe that the one-child policy kept China's population smaller than it would have been absent the one-child policy. I know that there are demographers that believe that China's population was already declining, but you know, I have, a wife whose mother had five siblings, whose grandmother had five siblings, who herself has five siblings. So I believe that the population train in China would have slowed down a lot slower without absent the one-child policy. Now, certainly there were myriad abuses of the one-child policy or actions taken by family planning officials under the guise of the one-child policy. I won't even say they were legal actions. And those are, of course, terrible. So I recognize the pragmatic difficulties of the implementation in many areas of the one-child policy, but I still fundamentally support any country's whether it's providing birth control in Africa or whatever, I support any country's efforts to limit population, just fundamentally. But it's certainly a lot more complicated. But that's very much American thinking, I think, in a lot of regards. You know, we as a people are very backward-looking, and we like to take our understanding today and recast our history within that understanding. But the reality is, in 1996, my belief was, there is a one-child policy, and these children are being abandoned and left on the streets to die by their birth families. And therefore, it behooves me to step forward and provide a home where I'm capable of doing so. And that was my, intent and motivation in 1996. That belief system wasn't even in any way impacted until 2002, when I adopted Megan. And then it was on that adoption trip that I began to see small cracks in that veneer, and subsequent events completely revolutionized my belief on the need for China's international adoption program. But I dealt with what I knew at the time, and even with Meilan's adoption, by that time we were, even though no scandals had broken out in China at that time, we were, both Lon and I were very well aware that there were issues with China's adoption program, especially as it related to healthy infants. And so when we met Meilan, we went through a lot to make sure that this was a girl that had no biological family available, had no domestic family that was willing to adopt her. We tried to cover every base to make sure that this would be an ethical adoption. And even after all of our effort, we still fell into the pit. All you can do is all you can do.
And you fell into the pit because, without going into a lot of detail, you actually discovered in the course of adopting Meilan that, in fact, there was a biological parent, correct?
The whole thing was a setup that we'd been deceived, yeah.
So 20 years hence, 1996, you felt one way. Today, it sounds like you don't fundamentally disagree with the government's policy, even a policy that dictates the number of children people can have. That philosophically, you don't fundamentally disagree with that. What you have real, genuine concerns about, what you've really lost faith with, is the international adoption program from China. Is that right?
Well, you know, there's a philosophical reasoning behind the one-child policy, and then there's the unforeseen and unfortunate results of that policy. Could it have been better implemented? Probably. I mean, certainly, you know, on the far side of the spectrum, you know, forced abortions and forced sterilizations and family planning confiscations. These are all acts that, are far outside the pale of what, you know, anybody would consider as appropriate activity to enforce, you know, one-child policy law. But just the idea that you establish fines for extra children, you promote the idea of one child, you, much like China's done, that one child is enough, boy or girl, it is the same, you know, each can pass on the family name, these kind of things to kind of slowly turn the population boat, I would support. Now, the problem is that even, you know, really before the one-child policy, there has always been a very fluid population of children inside China. My own wife, her sisters, all of them born before the one-child policy, all of them transferred to other families to be raised, by them. And that was, you know, that was the result of the idea that China was, by and large, very, very poor. And so, like all parents, Chinese families wanted what was best for their kids, to give their kids the best opportunities. And so, like in my wife's case, her family saw the village teacher as being a better, providing better opportunities for one of their daughters than they could, and so on. And so this fluid population of children that existed even before the one-child policy came in became a way of a method of abusing the one-child policy for adoption. I entered the adoption program thinking that these children were being left on the side of the road, that there was nobody that wanted them. And on my second adoption trip to adopt Megan, I was walking with the assistant director of her orphanage, and I asked, just, you know, off as a point of curiosity, you know, how many families do you have inside China that are adopting from your orphanage? And she says, oh, we have a 5-year waiting list. And that kind of was the beginning of my starting to look at things, saying, wait a second, you know, maybe everything I'd been told and believed about this program should be questioned. Because if there is 5 years worth of domestic families wanting to adopt from an orphanage that I, as a foreigner, am adopting from right now, this is a problem. And so I think that the international adoption program took the one-child policy and the dying rooms and the idea that the myth, really, that these children were being left on the sides of the road, and they were able to utilize that and take advantage of that to promote their program. And so, I still support the philosophy of the one-child policy, and I still, I've learned to be suspicious of the motives of those inside China that are working within the international adoption program.
I just wonder how much you've become sort of evolved into someone who believes that fundamentally at its core, these adoptions were really kind of fictions. Or am I overstating that?
No, I don't think you're overstating it. We have very few data points to draw on. Okay, so I mean, prior to 2000, China's program is kind of the the unknowable. We don't have the ability to collect, for example, finding data on children because, by and large, adoptive families are reluctant to share their children's stories, and there was no finding ads. And so we don't know much data about what was going on before 1999 and 2000. We do know from testimony that was given in the Hunan scandal, for example, that in 1996, orphanages in Hunan were already pressuring their employees to recruit children. Okay, and this was when the adoption program from China was in, you know, the low thousands, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 children. Already that was creating a strain on the orphanages to supply the children. And there was a incentive was being created to recruit children for adoption because the realization was there's enough families that are standing in line to adopt these children that if we can grab a child, submit it, flip it, and get the money, we can go out and get some more, and we can just keep doing that all day long. And so, I mean, we see stories in the press about children being abandoned, but it's the very fact that there are stories in the press about abandoned children that shows really how uncommon it is. You know, we were told in the early adoption period these kids are being found wholesale. Finding a child on the side of the street is like, man, I can't even walk down Main Street without finding children. But yet there were no stories about these kids being found, you know, and or if there were, they were so infrequent as to, you know, hardly be, they were rare. So that should have already been kind of a flag for us. But there's different levels, you know. Even if there had been children abandoned, in 2002, I realized that there were already enough families inside China to have adopted those children, that there really never really was a need for China's international adoption program, at least as it relates to the healthy children, that there were always families that were willing to adopt those children. And even if you accept that there were children abandoned, there still is very little justification for those children who have been adopted internationally.
Okay, so essentially then the international adoption program, in your view, was simply a method, another method, to lower the population. Rather than having many of these children adopted within China, as they traditionally might have been, sent to live with another family, they are in effect exported.
I don't think that the international adoption program was used as a way of lowering China's population. I think what the justification was, and you can call it an altruistic justification, is the reality that the children predominantly came from poor, uneducated, traditional rural families, and that these children were viewed as continuing that economic tradition, let's just say. Whereas if that child was adopted to a Western family, that child would be given a much better opportunity at life. And plus, it took a child out of that poor, uneducated, you know, superstitious culture or class. So I think it was viewed as a way of shifting the population to a higher level. By taking out the lowest denominators, you increase the average for the entire population, rather than as a way of just lowering the population. I don't think that was the rationale. I mean, in talking to directors, almost always when we asked them, you know, do you think it's good if a child is adopted domestically versus internationally, they always say, oh, absolutely, internationally is better. They have a much brighter future. And I think that really was a component of the program. The money, of course, was gravy to the program and became a motivation. But I think the overarching, if you sat down with a director and really asked them, they're not evil people, you know, by and large. They are people who believe, hey, I'm helping this child, I'm helping China, and gravy, I'm getting $5,000 because of that. You know, I think that's basically the hierarchy of the program.
But regardless of the motivation of the of the folks who, you know, the government for creating this international adoption program, you really believe that the vast majority of the children who have been internationally adopted, tell me if I'm overstating this, or a significant number of the children who have been internationally adopted probably could have found homes within China.
If they were a healthy young child, yeah. No question.
What is an adoptive parent to do with this at this point? Because, in your view, and an adoptee, because whatever has happened, this child is raised in this country. Many of these children have no memory of China. The only parents they've ever known are their adoptive parents. How do you think, as a community, what is our ethical obligation? What should we do if we accept that this program was deeply flawed, that these children might well have been able to stay in their country? Is there anything we should do? What should we do or not do?
To answer that question, you have to prioritize the needs of the players in the adoption community. So I would say that number one, and whose needs need to be foremost in any conversation, is the adoptee themselves. I mean, they're the primary victim / participant in the program. Okay, so their voice should be taken as the first voice. The second, secondarily to that would be the voices of the Chinese birth family and the adoptive family parents themselves. And last should be the voice of the adoption agencies and the governments. I would think that we should when our adoptive children come to us and ask for our help to provide information on their backgrounds, to help answer their questions, to do the searching, or whatever it is that they want to do to gain more information, we should, as adoptive parents, recognize that that is our primary objective as adoptive parents, that we should put aside our own fears and insecurities and familial myth and recognize that our children have these questions and we should do everything we can to answer them. At the same time, we should be educated ourselves and speak out when possible. I mean, there is a large contingency of families entering the adoption program who, for one reason or another, may not type into Google China adoption problems or something like that. They may not be they think they want to go to China to adopt, and they may not be willing to do a lot of pre-adoption research. So I think, as adoptive parents, when we recognize these issues, we should be speaking out to help others understand the adoption program before they go into the adoption. Otherwise, we're just this growing community of enlightened, and we're doing nothing to stop the abuses and to stop the problems inside China. It's only when we begin to speak out and campaign for change and reform will change ever come. Otherwise, the boat has passed us on the river, and we can't really change anything.
So how do you and Lon talk to your girls about this?
Well, I mean, primarily, Lon and I are talking all the time about different scenarios of different stories we're working on with families, different situations. Our girls are very well versed in, the issues with China's program and so on. And then if they have, individual questions, we always, sit around the table and talk about them. I mean, there's no desire to avoid a question or anything like that. But as you stated, all my kids are in, that zone where their number one goal is to just fit in with their friends and have a normal, American life. And they're not deep thinkers at this point and not asking, existential questions. So That will come. I mean, I think that primarily most people get to that point in their early 20s and mid-20s, and it might be when they're starting to have their own kids and they recognize, their own situation in contrast to having their own kids and so on. But it's almost guaranteed that the day will come when the child will start asking these questions. And you know, as adoptive parents, we have two choices. We can, say, well, you know, any searching for information is up to my daughter, you know, or my child. It's their story. They control it. It's not my prerogative to do any of this research. And you know, that's pretty much guaranteed to result in a frustrated child in her mid-20s whose trails are all cold and the people that knew her in the orphanage are all gone or dead. And there's just no expectation or even a hope that they'll ever be able to find information. Or you can be a parent who can see the future and can recognize that there's a high probability that that will become an issue for their child and will take the steps to be prepared when that day comes so that they can provide their child with as much information as is humanly possible. And, you know, obviously we side on those that are the, you know, long-range thinkers and try to get as much information as soon as possible, not necessarily to communicate to the child at the time, but at least there so that when the child does ask those questions, that the ability is there to answer them honestly and factually.
If you knew then what you know now about the Chinese adoption system, would you have adopted from China? And this is not saying anything that you don't love your daughters. They are wonderful, and you're glad that, you know, I'm not. I'm just saying purely in a as a kind of intellectual exercise.
Well, see, now you're asking me. I mean, there's an intellectual argument. The intellectual argument, of course, would say no. That I find it immoral to deprive a family inside China, ignoring, you know, the arrival of my kids into the orphanage, taking an agnostic view to that situation, but just from the idea that there are families inside China who are, like most families, wanting to have a child. I wasn't in that position. I was perfectly satisfied with the probability of never having children in life and not really, caring one way or the other. But I know that there are families inside China who desperately would love to have a child due to, you know, cultural and religious and, you know, everything reason, biological reasoning, that I would intellectually say, no, I would not go down that path again. Now, I have to balance that, philosophical idea against the reality that my kids bring immense pleasure and joy to my life. I mean, I look at my life before I had kids and I look at my life now and there's just really no comparison. I mean, the joy factor, the fulfillment factor, everything is so much higher I would be hard pressed to, if a being came to me and said, you can go back to 1997 and not turn in this dossier, just all you need to do is push this button, I don't think I would push it. Because the reality is my kids are my life. You know, I mean, they have brought me enrichment in so many different levels that I would not have without them, that it would be incomprehensible to me to unwind that and not do the path again. So I think in the end, I would say if I knew now what I knew then, I could see my life now back then, I would still